amenazas que recibía permanentemente en ese entonces de parte de los Figueroa, que bueno, todavía andan por ahí, y estuvo exiliado 4 años en Francia, sin poder regresar al país y mucho menos a su tierra. Fue por ahí alrededor del 2000-2001 que finalmente Ranferi logra regresar. Quiero destacar algo también de su actividad de dirigente y de luchador social, por reivindicaciones, desde luego, de las organizaciones campesinas que él venía representando, pero también destacar su participación política. En el año del 1994, cuando el levantamiento zapatista, el compañero Ranferi fue un agente clave cuando fundamos, fue fundador de lo que en ese entonces se denominó FAC-MLN, en coordinación con el STLN en esos tiempos, el Frente Amplio para la Construcción del Movimiento de Liberación Nacional. El compañero Ranferi, los compañeros Mesinos, etcétera, varios de ellos ya asesinados ahora. Los tiempos no han cambiado, o si han cambiado, tal vez han cambiado para mal. Esa es la lucha política que desde ese entonces el compañero Ranferi daba.
Max Correa es dirigente de la Central Campesina Cardenista.
Nuestro llamado enérgico también a las autoridades de este país, toda vez que se está generando un ambiente no solamente de persecución de dirigentes sociales, no solo en Guerrero, sino en otras entidades, Chiapas, Michoacán, Baja California Sur, Veracruz, otras entidades del país, está imponiéndose una conducta de persecución a dirigentes sociales, a dirigentes políticos, sindicales, campesinos, sociales, y vemos con preocupación que la salida fácil del Estado mexicano para atender estos temas es que en esas regiones donde suceden estos acontecimientos opera el crimen organizado, y esa es la salida sencilla y fácil para tratar de desviar el motivo de fondo de lo que implica, desde nuestro punto de vista, una conducta ya del Estado mexicano de persecución, de encarcelamiento y, en el extremo, del asesinato o la desaparición de dirigentes.
El secretario de la Central Independiente de Obreros Agrícolas y Campesinos, Engels López, no descarta que el asesinato de Hernández tuviera que ver con su renuncia al PRD y apoyo a López Obrador a un año de las elecciones.
El 2018 puede ser el parteaguas y el cambio de la historia. Eso puede suceder en este país. Por lo tanto, sostenemos que sí pudiera tener mucha relación este asunto de intentar la intimidación. No por primera vez en la vida, ya se ha hecho muchas ocasiones. Estados Unidos de Norteamérica tiene un modelo específico para detener, para torturar, para desaparecer líderes en el escenario político nacional. Lo tenemos aquí enfrente de Estados Unidos. México no es la excepción, el gobierno mexicano, digo, para imponer este tipo de situaciones y el ir eliminando, como lo ha hecho a través de la historia, a distintos líderes. Por eso sostengo que sí puede tener relación el hecho de la intimidación, es decir, van muy rápido. Pues nosotros queremos ir rápido, pues claro, queremos un cambio de modelo económico, no estamos de acuerdo con el que tenemos.
El M18 exigió al gobierno mexicano investigar el asesinato de Ranferi Hernández y castigar a los responsables, aunque dejó claro no creer de que eso ocurra ante la impunidad de los crímenes de líderes sociales en México. En Argentina, a más de 2 meses de la desaparición forzada del activista Santiago Maldonado, fue hallado un cuerpo en el río Chubut que ya había sido rastrillado en tres ocasiones. Verónica Heredia, abogada de la familia Maldonado, dijo que el cuerpo fue hallado en un lugar muy visible y no descartó que pudiera haber sido plantado. Santiago Maldonado desapareció el 1 de agosto durante un operativo de la policía contra indígenas mapuches a quienes estaba apoyando. Testigos aseguran que la última vez que lo vieron estaba siendo reprimido por la gendarmería, informa a Pepe Frutos del Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, Farco.
Según informó la Fiscalía en un comunicado, el cuerpo fue hallado a 300 metros río arriba desde el epicentro del conflicto del 1 de agosto. El juez federal Gustavo Geral, que encabezó este operativo, hizo declaraciones anoche y aclaró que todavía falta realizar algunas pericias para determinar la identidad.
Bueno, buenas noches. Recién acabamos de terminar un procedimiento muy extenso que nos demandó desde muy temprano de la mañana. Se ordenó un rastrillaje sobre el río Chubut y sus márgenes. Se convocó a personal especializado de la Prefectura Naval. Junto con un cuerpo de bomberos voluntarios que componen binomios con perros especialistas en buscar restos humanos en el agua.
Uh-huh. Esto hasta ahora no se había hecho, eso de los perros especialmente con esta característica.
Hasta ahora no se había hecho.
Doctor, ¿podemos confirmar?
Sí, déjenme terminar y les comento. Esto se logró luego de una extenso diálogo que todavía se mantiene con la comunidad, creo yo que es así, que ocupa el lugar, y bueno, de tratativas con ellos y con respeto mutuo sobre las decisiones. Fue una medida que se adoptó con un compromiso de parte de las fuerzas que iban a intervenir por orden mía. Sin ningún tipo de armamento y con solo las personas que iban a hacer la tarea, mis colaboradores y nadie más, por eso esta medida se mantuvo en reserva. Agradezco a toda la gente que concurrió al lugar para trabajar, incluso a la misma comunidad que prestó su colaboración desde el primer instante. Fue muy ardua la tarea, fue muy largo el día y bueno, todavía no hemos terminado de trabajar. No les puedo dar ningún tipo de dato más por respeto a la familia, así que yo les agradezco y tengo que seguir trabajando.
Recalcar esto, doctor, por el momento no hay ninguna confirmación oficial acerca de la identidad de ese cuerpo.
Todavía estamos trabajando y hay que tomar medidas urgentes que, bueno, no tenemos todos los elementos acá, así que yo me tengo que trasladar para seguir trabajando.
Escuchábamos al juez federal Gustavo Geral. Esto fue anoche, tras el operativo. La Fiscalía informó en el comunicado al que hacíamos mención que al sector donde se realizó el operativo accedieron los familiares de Santiago Maldonado, integrantes de la Asamblea Permanente por los Derechos Humanos y personal del Juzgado Federal. El Gobierno Nacional envió a Chubut al Secretario de Derechos Humanos, Claudio Abruz, que ayer mismo por la tarde ya estaba en Esquel. Periodistas cercanos al Gobierno habían adelantado que ayer, pasado el mediodía, habría importantes novedades en la causa. Esto cuando todavía no se sabía que había aparecido un cuerpo en el río Chubut.
En Colombia, integrantes de la ex guerrilla convertida en el partido Fuerza Alternativa Revolucionaria del Común, FARC, realizaron una protesta fuera de las oficinas del Alto Comisionado para la Paz. Allí demandaron que se aplique la ley de amnistía e indulto y que se cumpla el acuerdo de paz suscrito con el gobierno del presidente Juan Manuel Santos.
Organizaciones sociales y el partido político FARC adelantaron un plantón a las afueras de la oficina del Alto Comisionado para la Paz para exigir la aplicación efectiva de la ley de amnistía e indulto, así como el cumplimiento del acuerdo de paz.
Queremos decir que una guerrilla no se desarma para que la traicionen. Nosotros hemos cumplido a cabalidad todo lo acordado, desde el punto 1 hasta el punto 6. Dejamos todas las armas. Es más, antes de de que ellos cumplieran, nosotros hicimos la concentración en diferentes zonas del país y el gobierno hasta el día de hoy, ni siquiera muchas zonas no se han completado.
El incumplimiento del Estado colombiano se vive en distintos campos. Uno de ellos es el de la seguridad jurídica para los excombatientes. A más de 10 meses de aprobada la ley de amnistía, todavía más de 1.000 prisioneros políticos continúan en las cárceles del país a la espera de que el Estado colombiano les cumpla.
Nos toca nuevamente recurrir a estas jornadas de visibilización para que el gobierno tome carta en el asunto y nos cumpla con lo que está pactado. Lo mínimamente que pueden cumplir es poner la gente en libertad, porque ya están las leyes, está creado todo, hicimos dejación de armas y sin embargo siguen los incumplimientos.
Al no haber obtenido aún la libertad como fue pactado en el acuerdo de paz, los prisioneros políticos tampoco han podido comenzar el proceso de reincorporación a la vida civil. Integrantes del partido político Fuerza Alternativa Revolucionaria del Común señalan que los tropiezos en materia de reincorporación también lo viven los excombatientes que se encuentran en los espacios territoriales.
Frente a la inseguridad socioeconómica, no hay tierra, no hay dónde desarrollar los proyectos productivos, no se ha visto el primer recurso para la generación de esos proyectos y hay inseguridad financiera porque lo único que promete el gobierno son 0.7 puntos del Producto Interno Bruto para la implementación a 15 años. Esto, si no tiene un golpe de timón, va hacia un despeñadero.
Sin embargo, uno de los aspectos que genera mayor preocupación entre los integrantes de las FARC es el de la seguridad personal. En lo que va del año, 19 excombatientes han sido asesinados y 11 familiares de estos, cifras que podrían aumentar. En las últimas horas, organizaciones de derechos humanos denunciaron que 2 exmilicianos fueron asesinados en el departamento de Nariño y 2 exguerrilleros fueron secuestrados por paramilitares en el mismo territorio.
En todos los puntos del acuerdo hay graves incumplimientos de parte del gobierno nacional y esto desde luego solo envía un mensaje de desconfianza generalizado a que este acuerdo pueda entrar en riesgo y que lo que se acordó pues fracase.
El incumplimiento del Estado no solo aplica para los exguerrilleros, también para las comunidades que han vivido el conflicto armado. Muestra de ello es la realidad que siguen viviendo los campesinos en el municipio de Tumaco. Aunque el gobierno nacional les prometió la sustitución voluntaria de los cultivos de uso ilícito, lo que rige en este momento es la erradicación forzada que ha cobrado la vida de varios campesinos. Lorena Hoyos, Telesur, Bogotá, Colombia.
Y aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de RTN, de Telesur, del colectivo Más Voces, de Radio de Naciones Unidas, del Informativo Farco, de Hispan TV, de Venezolana de Televisión y del diario La Jornada. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
And next up on Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, it's the Thursday, October 19, 2017 edition of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. Stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs, they simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So, welcome to another show here. This has got to be a kind of a quick intro because most of the show is going to be covered with part one of Keith McHenry's last Saturday interview with KSCO and assorted critics. I'd like to say bigots, and it's probably an accurate statement, but why not be more temperate? And that's going to be happening shortly into the show. But first, there's going to be a real flashback, well, long ago flashback. It's actually back 28 years to June of 1989 and a KZSC show, the Ancient Talkabout show, with food activist and homeless civil rights activist Sandra Loringer, who ultimately was convicted of serving free food at the town clock and served around a month in jail. I think it was 3 weeks, maybe a little more. It made international headlines as far away as India. And actually, to some extent, yeah, I think her case, as well as those who worked with her, and I was one of them, and so were many others, responsible for Food Not Bomb's success in being able to fight and to maintain a service for poor people and organizing and community for poor people outside the post office, where it currently continues to serve on Saturdays and Sundays, 4 to 6. So you're going to hear, I think it's Tom Murphy, I may have his name wrong, do a lengthy interview, or Dan Murphy, don't know, it's been a long time, with Sandra Loringer, who actually ran an antique store on Pacific Avenue, and then as homeless activism kind of rose to a crest in the fall of 1988, the previous year, she joined with them and began to serve food and work with Jane Immler and Linda LeMaster and Linda Edwards in, well, actually that was about the time HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, was created, and also a group called Bag Ladies Revolt, which embarrassed then-Mayor Marty Wormhout, another one of those pretend progressives on homeless issues. And Wormhout ordered the police into the town clock to start arresting people, which they did, and it caused quite a controversy in Santa Cruz, and it's discussed shortly. I encourage you to listen to it. I may be doing the second part of Keith McHenry's last Saturday, October 14th interview on KSCO. If I don't, you'll be able to follow it by going to the KSCO website where it's available. And he does a good job, as Keith always does. There may be a bit of familiar talk about his history, but Keith always adds new stuff to it, and I'm glad that he does. So check that out. That'll be happening after the Loringer interview. A few announcements. Tonight, that's October 19th, Thursday, at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, there's going to be findings of the countywide research on the affordable housing crisis in Santa Cruz and Watsonville unveiled, according to the announcement I got over the email. UCSC faculty and students will share the results of surveys and interviews with over 1,700 local residents to understand how respondents are experiencing the housing crisis. And this event kicks off, of course, Affordable Ha 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 Housing Week. I just love this terminology that Mayor Chase and others like to throw around that has nothing to do with real living conditions or what the city council is actually doing in Santa Cruz. Then on Tuesday, about a week from now, a little bit less, there's going to be the Rents Are Too Damn High protest. That's going to be at the Santa Cruz City Hall from 4:30 to 6:30. That's on the 24th. So it's going to be, I guess, around the time of the city council meeting. That's going to be a protest for housing justice, demand a freeze on rents, and no-cause evictions. That's because people are going to meet at 4:30 at the Resource Center for Nonviolence parking lot, 612 Ocean, march to City Hall for 5:15 public comment. Maybe they have some special deal with Chase. It's usually at 5. And then there'll be a tenants' rights assembly at 6 p.m. outside City Hall, which hopefully will be the real action. The idea of people spending their time focusing on a deaf and dumb, in both senses of the word, actually, they do jabber a lot, so we really can't call them speechless. City council is always, although I do it, I go jabber at them too, seems to me to be a real waste of energy, and organizing with each other is a much better idea. Tonight at City Hall, right across from the so-called affordable housing unveiling of their study, there's going to be a planning commission meeting that will have on its agenda as the third item
municipal code amendments for commercial cannabis regulating in Santa Cruz. This came to the City Council for sort of an initial pass a couple of weeks ago, and then and now, I think it was either a couple of weeks ago, I think it was actually almost a month ago, but it was sent to the Planning Commission and will probably be coming back to City Council, I would guess, on the 24th, the same day as the tenant assembly at City Hall. This is pretty much, it looks like the Planning Commission is going to recommend what the City Council wants them to, rather than necessarily what's best. So, for example, there'll be a complete ban on any dispensaries that will be able to, well, where you'll be able to recreationally smoke or vape or ingest marijuana, because, you know, marijuana is a dangerous drug, you see. This is the incredible reefer madness mythology that the City Council and its appointees on the Planning Commission sedulously follow, sort of like some ancient religious ritual, some ancient fantasy and mythology, some ancient hysteria, actually. Planning Commission will be taking public testimony, and it will also be forwarding its probably pro forma recommendation to the City Council, though I imagine if enough people showed up with joints in hand or at least a determination in their stride, things might change. But there's a recommendation that medical marijuana dispensaries be, that all dispensaries, including medical marijuana dispensaries, be limited to 5, that the 2 medical marijuana dispensaries which the city grudgingly agreed to allow, and which it then restricted in 2010, allowing no others, but saying, oh, this is a temporary moratorium. And even though the police department reported absolutely no problems with the medical marijuana dispensaries, the city has declined to expand and allow medical marijuana dispensaries and similarly recreational dispensaries, though they are allowing 5, including the two medical marijuana dispensaries grandfathered in. And again, this is a preliminary action by the Planning Commission, which will then be taken to the City Council so that the commercialization can begin. There's no mention of WAM, which is Women and Men for Medical Marijuana, which sought special attention by the City Council and will probably get it, and probably should, except, of course, I always say this, when WAM does its little special pleading and gets its special deals, this needs to be, it needs to use its power to expand these rights to those who aren't covered by the 200 or 300 people who are in WAM. And it's never done so, that I'm aware of. The notion that there's also, you know, there's a lot to be said about this, and I am unfortunately, I don't have time to talk about it. It is online if you want to go, by the time you're hearing this, if you really want to get involved, you know, hike on down or bike on down or get your butt on down to City Hall or get on the email and start sending them emails. I'm not sure if you can send the Planning Commission an email during its Planning Commission commissioning time. But they are meeting tonight at 7 o'clock. And I don't think this will come up until the third item on the agenda. So if you're hearing this, you should have at least an hour or more to get down there if you want to be heard on the issue or observe what's going on. I hope that's people who are observing, because I don't think this is televised, and that's too bad. Maybe it is. If that's so, that's great. But I hadn't heard that the Planning Commission hearings were televised. Let me know what went down. I'm hoping to talk with the elusive, oh so elusive, never returns his calls, Pat Malo of the Cannabis Advocates Alliance, who's also meeting up on in Felton at the community hall up here, 4:30 to 6:30 on Sunday, in case you want to wander down and hear what they have to say. They're probably going to strike one of their usual deals with authorities, which I suppose, as growers, you know, they're not getting burned out by the fires, then their livelihood there depends to some extent on what's going on, so that's supposed to be an excuse. Of course, I hear the same thing about police officers. You know, that's why we should respect their failure to speak up when other officers engage in brutality or against policies of criminalize the homeless, because see, they have to. It's just their job, and they would that sort of thing. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. Limits on the marijuana, like they're limiting cultivation areas to 10,000 square feet, thanks to Cynthia Matthews and other people like Chirazes who are treating marijuana like a dangerous drug. Prohibiting delivery services from businesses located in the city, though they can't stop them from using the public roads. That's all I've got time for. Enjoy Keith McHenry at KSCO and Sandra Loringer standing up and essentially saying to the judge, Your Honor, when she is told by Judge Robert Attuck, after she was convicted of distributing free food without a permit with no health problem whatsoever, he said, if we'll put you on probation, you don't have to go to jail. And she then turned to the judge and said, Your Honor, I think I am beyond rehabilitation. And indeed, after she got out of jail, she went right back to what she was doing before, and the city stopped arresting food servers. Nice work, Sandra Loringer and Jane Immler, and a lot of other people. Malou, Linda Edwards, even Brian Flanagan Staley, a whole bunch of folks have made it so that Food Not Bombs can now serve people can do what it did, although Food Not Bombs is getting arrested massively in San Francisco and fighting the same fight. And Keith McHenry did come down here in 1988 himself and in solidarity with the food servers. Maybe playing some of that, and we have an interview from 1988 with Keith at that time too. But first, let's listen in to Keith in 2017. Okay, well, today is October 17th. It's about 2:25 in the afternoon. Just getting a call from Wildfire over in the Monterey County area. Hi, Wildfire.
Hello, Robert.
So what's happening? You've got some new stuff to report.
Well, upgrade is they did come down hard today clearing out the lapis. So they really kind of, like, shoot out everybody. They shoot everybody off the lapis. I just started recently, at the Dole cooler, across from Dole, parking there with the other RVs. And then the sheriff came over there and ran everybody out of Dole's area there.
Now, at what time did this happen?
About a half hour ago.
Okay, and were you told and were others told not to come back or just for the day?
Not park here.
Can't park here is what they said.
So what are we supposed to do during the day because we got a ticket?
This is Patrick. Hold on.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello. My name is Pat.
Hi, I'm Robert.
Howdy. We're just parked there because we, can't park Lapis during the day. So we go down the road. We don't have much gas at the moment. Kind of like in the middle of the month. And it's a short distance to drive to park there by the truckers and stuff, and we're there, and they just came rousing everybody, telling them they need to leave. We're going to, give you guys tickets. And I told her, what are we supposed to do during, 10 o'clock in the morning to 6 at night? I mean, we can legally park on Lapis at night, but during the day, and now you're kicking us out here, what are we supposed to do? You guys, that's up to you to figure out. You guys need to leave.
And how many people were you estimated told to leave?
Five to ten
people or 5 to 10 vehicles?
5 to 10 vehicles, I'd imagine.
And how many deputies were involved?
2 women sheriffs.
Okay, and did anybody get tickets?
Not that I know of. We didn't. We were leaving, and that's when we started talking to them. They were taking pictures of our vehicles.
And was this the first time this has happened during the day on Lapis Road? Or near that?
No. I mean, every now and again, they come during the day and really stick to their guns and making you leave.
And has anyone gotten a ticket on Lapis Road for either being there or not leaving?
I believe so, yes.
Do you know how many tickets that you've heard about?
Oh, a couple, 2.
And what has happened to those people? Have they continued to come back or have they disappeared?
I really don't know. I really couldn't tell you.
Gotcha. So, This happened half an hour ago, more or less.
And actually what they did is very insulting. I come out and, I was talking to him. And, you know, she's telling him, he's talking about, well, you know, where can we park and all this. And she's like,
you can go to an RV campsite and all this stuff right. that I can't afford. She tells me, well, you can get a job and I'm disabled for very good reason right now and make only $1,000 a month. You cannot physically work a job. And she has no idea about any of this stuff. And just starts belittling me, telling me, why can't you go get a job and da 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 da. And so I just literally walked away and said, good day, ma'am. I'm not going to sit here and have you belittle me and put me down and, you know, chastise me. So I just walked away.
Patrick, next time, turn on a recording device and record what...
After that, I grabbed my video recorder and Wildfire commenced to talking to her about, you know, her situation and reasons why people can't go do these black and white things they think are just so easy that people should just go do. And that's when I flipped it on and I did.
Good.
Her and Wildfire... back and forth, and she got really deterred when I did that. She pulled out her own little camera device
right.
and started videoing me like it was going to harm me or something. I don't care. I'm just protecting myself.
Right.
And then
right.
she turns to me and she goes, is he for real? You know, like, is Pat for real for filming me, the sheriff? And I just, like, totally ignore her. I knew exactly what she was trying to get me to do. She's known me before from the first time they tagged our RV because I saw her, you know, I'm out here because I'm a victim of a domestic crime. And I guess she was checked up on my story and found out that it was true. So, you know, she's like, well, Florence, come on. You know that, you know, I'm not, you know, this is nothing personal and everything. And then we got into discussion that I could go into, you know, Section 8 housing, like, you know, putting a little yeah. room in there. And I said, are they going to allow me to have my cat and my bird, who's been a great emotional support for me? And... she's like, well, no, probably not, because, you know, I said, well, then I don't want to do that. She says, well, you see, that's why you make your choice. You make your choice.
Like talking down to you like you're a child or like you're some drug addict.
No, for 1 second, I felt like, hold on a second, I'm being bullied by this sheriff like she would a heroin addict. You made a choice. You're the one who made that choice. And it's like, almost for that second, you almost feel like a criminal. And then you realize, like, wait a minute, hold on.
Good.
Don't turn it on me like this. No, it's not going to happen.
Good.
You know? So that was a whole experience there.
Tell me you want to do it.
Good work. I mean, did you... is that audio available for playing on the radio that you got with her, or either you or Patrick got?
Yeah, I have it. It's recorded.
Okay, well, you know, if you want, when we're finished with this... interview, if you want to replay it, it might not be the best quality, but if it's still audible, we can see if, you know, people can hear it when I play the Thursday night broadcast.
Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be perfect.
And what about you, Wildfire?
I'm just appalled by how, you know, I mean...
No, I mean, is
her and I, she's bullying me, and...
Yeah, is what you recorded of hers audible?
Oh, is it audible? Yes.
Okay, well, can you...
I haven't seen it or played it back. It's a video audio.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you want, why don't you, if you've listened to it and you're satisfied that it's something you want to go out on the air... it sounds like it is, but you know, you be the judge.
It's not long.
Yeah, you can play it right now, or you can call me back when you're ready to do that. Both of you.
Well, you can play it to me now, and then you can see what it sounds like.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so you'll go get his camera.
Alrighty. So, Have there been any further meetings of the Lapis Road Residential Association or Homeowners Association?
You were up to date when we went and did the petition the Sunday before last, right?
I believe so, yeah. And then I understand you got sick. That's what I heard from Wes and Becky.
No, I'm talking about when we did the Sunday.
Right. I heard that you got signatures, and then he took them on the Tuesday to the... the Board of Stupid Vipers, and he and Becky came to the
Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom meeting here in Santa Cruz. I guess that was last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And anything happened last Sunday, or did, you know, is any more petitioning?
I'm trying to get together, you know, some ideas from the Lapis Road Homeowners Association. I'm keeping up on doing the petition signing, getting the public to know us. We are working on a few ideas, and one of them might be like a discussion show. Of all this on Lapis, and it's going to be from different, like one representative of each group, like a representative for the workers group, and the disabled group, and, you know, the students, the domestic crime group, and so the public knows what each individual is different. We're not all to be judged just off of one experience, off of one group.
Sounds good. Did Patrick show up with his? You show up with your video, audio, Patrick?
Yeah, he's trying to listen to it right now.
Okay.
Hold on.
Do you want to call me back when it's queued up?
Is it queued up? It's queued up.
All right, go for it. And turn up the volume.
So, he's going to see mine. I'm going to see mine. I can't park anywhere in order for long enough to get an appointment. And it's just really awesome about worrying about getting sick and away, you know?
Founding member of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco. We got an interview with him about a week ago. And also, we're expecting a phone call from a local activist who served food and has been found guilty of serving food. And she's going to give her story about what's happening here in Santa Cruz on that issue. So it's another food rights program for you. And this first up from Lou Reed.
It's June 25th, 1989. You're listening to KZSC and more to come.
It's Lou Reed, Office East Santa Cruz. And we're going to give you our first feature, which is an interview with Keith McHenry. Keith McHenry, one of the founders of the organization Food Not Bombs that operates in Boston, Cambridge, and San Francisco, among other places, which he will mention in the interview. The group is started in Boston about 1980, and its main purpose is to both educate people on the arms race and how it takes away from needed social services or needed resources for people. And at the same time, while it's educating people about this, it's giving away food. Food Not Bombs serves food every day, or at least 5 days a week in the Bay Area, San Francisco. So there is an organized group doing that up there in Santa Cruz. It has it's still being fought to get that legalized. So we're going to go to Keith McHenry, and he'll tell you how Food Not Bombs did it up in the Bay Area.
Yeah, I'm Keith McHenry with Food Not Bombs.
All right. I guess I'd like to ask a little bit about how it was getting started. Right now you're pretty well established, right? And you have meals five times a week.
At least five times a week, sometimes 7 days a week. And how we got started is we were in Clamshell Alliance in Boston. And as the demonstrations grew up there, we started realizing we needed to do more peace work in town around Seabrook. And the First National Bank of Boston was an investor of Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. And the board of directors of the First National were also the board of directors of Seabrook. So they were making the decisions. And we were doing education on interlocking directors and how the first also was building nuclear bombs in Boston at the same time that they were building Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant. So we thought, well, we'll serve food out in front of the stockholders meeting of the First National Bank of Boston, and we'll dress up as though we're poor, we're in the Depression, and so have a soup line saying your policies are going to create a situation where this has to exist. Then we realized, like within a few minutes even, that that's insane. We should just serve the real people that are really affected by this, and we'll leaflet them. So we did, and we had 300 people show up to eat food, and we had this great festival of free food out in front of the stockholders meeting, and the stockholders were really moved by it. And so from that time on, we started doing this all the time to, you know, like wherever stockholder meetings were, or when George Bush came to speak at MIT, we gave away huge amounts of food. And it evolved so that after a while, we were able to just call our own actions. And we would have demonstrations every 2 months outside of Draper Laboratory and give away free food in Boston. And then we ended up with all this waste food, because once we put the word out, we would accept waste food. And it meant that we then had to cook meals for people in the housing projects. And then we started taking bulk food to every housing project and every shelter in the city.
So what year was that then?
That started in May of 80. And so now it's 89. We've done 9 years this May. And then we moved about a year and a half, two years ago, to San Francisco, some of us. And so this still happens in Boston every day. And then we just fed the demonstrators at the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, where about 750 people were arrested doing CD last weekend. And the weekend before that, we were at a Gatling gun factory, where we're blocking a Gatling gun factory. And we sped everyone for a week outside of that in western Massachusetts. And then
is that a nuclear manufacturer?
No, Gatling guns are actually just anti-personnel weapons that send large sprays. There's like something like 60,000 bullets a minute going out of this Gatling gun off of helicopters and stuff. Okay. And they're the things that just maim like hundreds of people, and they can only be used to kill people. Not
different, like Central America has a lot of this helicopters.
Right.
Guatemala, I believe.
Right, they gave them for free to Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador has them for free, and they also have been giving them to like in Africa, also to South Africa, and they're used in Korea against the South Korean people by the Korean military. So it's like used by the U.S. all over the world. And so we still do that there. And we also been serving food in D.C. at national marches. And then in California, we serve like all on the streets all over San Francisco. And we feed between the lowest number of people is about 300 a day, and the highest is in about 1,500 a day, depending on the if it's the beginning of the month or the end of the month, and how many people are in need. And it's required. Like, we still repel the police. They still give us some hard times, but only verbally, and they haven't arrested us in 2 months.
Yeah, so that is sort of a victory then, because when you first set up at Golden Gate Park, weren't you arrested, taken away?
Right, well, we were in Golden Gate Park from May to August with no problems with the police at all. And then this group of realtors called the Coal Valley Improvement Association called out the police. It turned out the police had started Coal Valley Improvement as a community group to oppose the poor in the neighborhood. And so it's like a very corrupt thing where the police started this community group. And in fact, all these new citizen action groups called Project Safe are nothing but police snitch organizations, much like they had in Nazi Germany, where they would develop neighborhood organizations. The police department would set them up to do the work of the police, which was to turn in all your neighbors. And so they're doing that on a national basis in America. And we were the victims of that. And the police came out. 45 riot police showed up on August 15th and arrested 9 of us for serving food. And then they didn't arrest us the week after that, saying that they were going to offer us a building. But as we have now seen, Mother Teresa was offered a firehouse, which was outside of town, and no one goes there to eat because it's too dangerous and too far away from where anybody would be. So we were wise to that. We told them we'd accept the building, but we're going to do it also in the streets, because we're both educational as well as providing a service. And the mayor and city officials kept saying, well, you can't be a service and educational. It's not a concept that can exist. And we kept saying, it is a concept that does exist, and we are that concept, and we are existing. And so eventually, after they arrested 94 of us illegally, there was no laws keeping us from doing this, which is an interesting fact. They had neglected to make laws denying people the right to give away free food. And they had gotten to the point where they said that the law, their interpretation of the law was that you had to get a health permit and liability insurance and a food distribution permit if you wanted to share even half a sandwich with one other person. So it turned out it was an entirely bogus thing, and they eventually stopped arresting us, and so we've done it ever since. The last arrest, mass arrest, was on September 5th, Labor Day.
Last year.
And we're going to have a very large celebration in Golden Gate Park on September 4th, Labor Day, Monday, this coming year. So we're getting a lot of bands together and so on to promote that. And we've served every Monday, even through the arrest, to this day, at Hayden Stanyan. So.
Okay, so you said you have a message. You're educational as well as providing a service. So just what is that?
The message that we have is that money should be spent on providing food and shelter and clothing and not on bombs. And one of the things is some people say, well, that, you know, there is a direct relationship that $300 billion a year is being spent on weapons every year, while only like less than a billion is spent on providing it all for the homeless, and also like welfare rolls and all that are like only a couple of billion dollars total in the whole country. And yet here $300 billion is spent on preparing for a war that we theoretically are not having. Basically, the weapons manufacturers are making in the area of a couple of $100 billion, or like around $100 billion to $150 billion a year profit, which they're pocketing, that is just pure money that they get because they manufacture all these weapons. And then the Congress people are also the owners of the weapons companies. So they're the people buying it, and they're the ones selling it, and they're doing it with our money. And they're making themselves very rich, while millions of people are starving in America. There's 3 million people living on the street, or 500,000 children that live on the streets, at the very least. And Congress says there could be as many as 21 million by the year 2000 Americans living on the streets of this country. And that's the kind of national security issue that's more significant than whether the Russians are going to invade the United States, and which is a totally fabricated concept that's made just to get us to pay out all of our tax dollars to build weapons to make these guys rich. And so we're basically dupes of these super rich guys. While it is not bad to write your congresspeople, and it's not bad to lobby, and it's not bad to vote, the other message that we have is that we're the ones that are going to change the situation. So we're hoping that there'll be not only food, not bombs in the cities all across America. Right now they're in Sacramento, Boston, Cambridge, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco and Berkeley. And we're hoping that they'll become like homes not bombs, plumbers not bombs, electricians not bombs, clothes manufacturers not bombs, healthcare workers not bombs, every imaginable thing. And basically all the things that we need in society that we are not getting right now because all the emphasis is on military, that we will just start doing these activities ourselves without going and getting these permits to do these activities. We'll just do them, and then this eventually there'll be all the services we need to survive will be happening, and all the people involved in doing that will just be all doing it. And basically, slowly, a new country will be happening where people work for peace and they just do the tasks that need to happen to survive and don't waste any of their energy or time on the military angle of it. And that's really the survival thing that we need to do now. And of course, some scientists and so on are saying that we should do this immediately. 100% of all people should stop driving cars right now, or we're going to have the greenhouse effect and we'll all be wiped out. And that's the message even from the U.S. government. Scientists are saying that, even though Bush administration rewrote their reports, which they then had to protest to have, you know, given out correctly. So it's like an emergency situation, and it should happen automatically. And the homelessness is a serious medical emergency right now. It's a thing that has to be, you know, there's like 3-4 million people. Maybe Harvard University says there's 6 million Americans on the streets. So it's like a major problem that has to be dealt with right this second.
Well, you know, I'm from Santa Cruz, and this will be playing in Santa Cruz, and the homeless people in Santa Cruz are well known in that town, and they've gone through a lot in the last year and a half trying to get free food out. Do you have any, comments about what's gone on there, or opinions?
Well, the thing that's most disturbing about Santa Cruz is it's basically the city, which is supposedly a progressive liberal government, has gone to the point of basically outlawing people entire class of human beings and saying these people are against the law as human beings, and that they have to basically, according to the law in Santa Cruz, you're supposed to stand up and walk around pacing from the hours of like 9:30 at night to 6 in the morning, and that you're only, but a certain class of people are only allowed to sleep in the day, and then they're not allowed to sleep in the day because it becomes another law. So it's basically, there's hundreds of people in Santa Cruz that have been told, because you only make this amount of money, for whatever reason, I've talked to a lot of people down there that are people that have been released from mental hospitals, and there's people that have always lived there, and now they've been made outlaws, and their families and their relatives are there, and they're that's their community, and now they're illegal people, and they were born in America, they were raised in America, and now they're illegal by existing, and that is obscene. And then the further harass people because they're trying to eat. They're sharing food. Like if any of the city supervisors were to go to the boardwalk and share meals with each other, they wouldn't expect to be arrested. But here, other poor people that are sharing meals with them are arrested, and it's just totally a class war. And you know, a place like Santa Cruz is supposed to be a very progressive, cutting edge of America type place with a university audience and all that. It should be happening, you know, like in a much more progressive way than it is, and they should be ashamed of themselves, the city government. And I've served food down there myself. In fact, some of the first arrests, I was actually the one serving the food, and some older women were apprehended instead of me, and they weren't even serving the food, and that's like totally crazy, you know. But you know, it's obscene. I would get arrested, and I told them, and I think the people down there agree that it's such a sick thing that if you got arrested thousands of times every day trying to give out free food, that is much better than to just be complacent and allow that kind of, that's like a really immoral crime against humanity. And those people shouldn't, that live in, you know, the mayor of Santa Cruz, she should be totally ashamed of herself.
And that was Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs in San Francisco. Our next guest or speaker will be calling us, Sandy Lorenzen, Sandy Loringer, who is a downtown merchant, incidentally, and she was arrested and found guilty of serving food. So she'll be talking with us in just a moment. And first, here's some music. Back at KZSC, Santa Cruz, you're listening to Earthbeat, and we have a guest on the phone, Sandy Loringer, who was just convicted of serving soup without a permit in at the city town clock last December, I believe. Hi. Or January, rather. I'm sorry. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to Earthbeat. So you just had a trial this past week. Do you want to talk about that, what happened?
I'll attempt to. The trial was fairly short, as trials go. I was found guilty. Strangely, I don't feel guilty. I don't feel like a criminal. I feel very wonderful, as a matter of fact. The sentencing will take place on July the 6th, and that should be an interesting occasion. I'm not really looking at the probability of probation. So it'll be interesting to see what the alternatives may be.
Are you thinking they might sentence you to do some jail time, or that you're going to refuse probation if offered?
Yes. I just don't know how many alternatives there are, and we'll just have to wait and see. But jail time is certainly possible.
Uh-huh. Now, what exactly were you convicted of?
Serving food without a health permit.
Uh-huh. And you had attempted to get a health permit?
I personally have not, but a couple of other persons did attempt to do that back in November. Tom Naughty, our bubble man in town, and Linda Lamaster. Much of the time, the food is cooked in home kitchens, and they can never receive a health permit. It's interesting because millions of women and men daily prepare meals for families and guests and friends, And yet, I can't cook in my kitchen and then take it outdoors and serve it to someone.
Well, this seems kind of surprising because there are all sorts of church groups and so forth. It's my understanding that.
And they're doing the identical activity, and they're not being prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. So technically, even sharing a cookie with someone, someone down, say on the mall downtown Santa Cruz, would be violation of the law you were convicted on.
Well, you know, that's been known to happen, but actually, nonprofit organizations can serve food to the public three times in 90 days.
Without having to get a permit.
Without having to get a health permit. But I happen to know personally of many groups and organizations that do indeed serve food to the public much more often than that.
Mm-hmm. So do you think this was like a selective prosecution, that there were larger political issues that...
Very definitely. There's no question about that. Interestingly, my attorney, Peter Leeming, that was his defense, was the discriminatory prosecution. But the judge ruled it unacceptable, so it was not allowed as his defense for the trial. So he kind of had to wing it. But he did a beautiful job from beginning to end, and I was really very honored to have been represented by him. He approached it from very humanistic. A basic need of the human body. A meager cup of soup is all this is about.
Well, what gets you started on this help to the homeless people? How did you become involved?
Well, I've always been concerned about the persecuted groups within our society. The poor, the needy, the sick. I've always been concerned because I've seen how badly they're treated by all of us. You know, we've all inflicted some kind of pain upon them and made judgments. And I think Keith McHenry said it earlier here on your broadcast that, you know, we treat them as being less than human, and they're beautiful people. You know, they laugh and they cry and they feel happiness and grief, and I just have a real dedication and commitment to attempting, in an attempt to do something. I just detest the suffering that takes place around me. And I can no longer walk away from it or turn my back on it. And I saw this issue of hunger here in Santa Cruz, and probably most people would claim that such a problem doesn't exist here. Or if it does, there is some blame for it, that the person who's hungry should be blamed for that condition. And they don't agree with that. I saw an area where I could do something. I could participate and maybe make a difference. And within a half an hour of that participation, I was in jail. And as Keith McHenry said, he referred to myself and Jane. No, I don't think Jane was there that day. I and another woman. He referred to us as two older women that were arrested. Well, I am one of those older women that actually did not serve any of the food.
Well, that was another issue I was curious about. You actually didn't serve food, and yet you were convicted of serving soup without a permit.
There are so many paragraphs in this health and safety code. You need a permit to prepare it, you need a permit to handle it, you need a permit to transport it, to distribute it, to serve it. It's extremely complicated. So if they can't get evidence that you've served it, they will attempt to get evidence that you've touched it, perhaps. that will prove that you've handled it. It's been quite interesting the way these arrests and prosecutions have taken place. There just seems to be a real determination to put a stop to it.
Has it been successful in getting to any of the meals?
The meals do continue, not on as regular a basis as several months ago. They do continue, but they're a little bit irregular.
Uh-huh.
And they no longer take place at the town clock.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't seemed to have made any of the local government officials any happier. I really feel that perhaps, you know, backs would be turned upon this alleged crime if it took place where it weren't visible.
Yeah, that seems to be the issue. Like this last winter, the city did start its own food program at the River Street Shelter. It seems this kind of a ploy to get poor people away from the mall.
Before my participation, but between 5 and 6 weeks of duration. Interestingly, it was during that Christmas shopping season, and it may have simply been a measure to attempt to remove the people from the town clock area where they were visible to the shoppers and take them behind the River Street Shelter and provide them with a meal, which, by the way, was funded with FEMA money. The city government didn't mm-hmm. put out any funds to cover that food.
Uh-huh. And what you're doing isn't costing the taxpayers anything. Well, I mean, in terms of the food you're giving away, you're not asking for the city to pay for this food or anything. You're doing it yourself, right?
That was the beauty of this, is that we were addressing a need that existed in the community, and we weren't asking any area of the government for anything. It feels to me that we're in that space where we need to reach out to each other, and we need to try to fulfill the needs that exist without constantly turning to the government and asking for more help. So much money is tied up in the system, in the bureaucracy, and in salaries, and departments, and agencies, and, you know, for a little over $10 a day, you know, we could feed close to 100 people. It was only a cup of soup, but it was hot, and it was healthy, and it was nutritious. That's quite a feat.
That's really a wonderful thing. It's amazing that the government put so much energy to stop it.
From time to time, that they weren't pleased.
Mm-hmm. One point is, I'm told I should make a legal ID for our station towards the top of the hour. You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz. We're talking with Sandy Loringer, recently convicted for serving soup near the town clock. Now, you're a downtown merchant yourself, and some of the soup your group has been serving is also from a downtown restaurateur, India Joe's and Joseph Schultz.
Yeah.
So the business community isn't entirely in support of what the city is doing, apparently.
It's my indication that for the most part, the business community is against this activity. I have stepped forward and abandoned that business person mentality. My area of focus is that there be no hunger, not how much money I can make from my business. I'm just not that concerned about it. Joseph Schultz from India Joe's has been participating for several months. We did in the past have several other restaurants also helping us. And from time to time, just somebody will walk down the street and drop off a box of cookies or a bag of potato chips or some oranges or some apples or something. And when I hear that that's happened, I always pray that they won't be nabbed by a police officer the next time they attempt to do it. I just don't think the average citizen realizes that that kind of activity is not innocent in this town.
Mm-hmm. Well, also the community's resources in courts are being tied up by a lot of trials right now. Like, I believe there's yours was maybe the second conviction, and there's maybe six more trials coming up.
Yeah, I have another trial coming up in August, another illegal food-serving trial coming up in August.
Mm-hmm.
I think there may have been a little bit of surprise that I intended to follow through on it. But I see no crime having been committed.
Mm-hmm. Have you been getting much support from the community for your stance?
Verbally, from time to time, yes.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some of that comes from the strangest places, and I don't think I would want to make any statement on the air, but great concern and sympathy comes in, but usually verbally. The average person is not in a position to put themselves out on the line and risk being arrested,
mm-hmm.
bringing down a bag of sandwiches and passing them out.
Are these convictions going to be appealed, do you know?
I believe so. Peter and I haven't had a chance to talk about it. I would think so. He also is extremely busy, but I believe that he feels a certain commitment to this issue.
Now, if our listeners were listening to Keith speaking earlier on that tape, one of the things he pointed out was that you know, there were a number of mass arrests for food giveaways in San Francisco, and ultimately when it got to the courts said the state law doesn't apply to that what they were doing, and it seems apparently this is the only jurisdiction in the state where that law is being applied the way it's been applied on you.
That's true, and it's my understanding that this particular issue may never have arisen before in quite this context as it has here in Santa Cruz, which is really a shameful thing. We've pretty much been through this health and safety code with fine-tooth comb, but the district attorney's office seems quite determined to want to prosecute these cases. And the judges are ruling that the exceptions that we felt we fell under in the health and safety code doesn't hold true. So it's just two different communities handling what they see to be a problem in two different fashions.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't believe in the long run that this will continue to be the case. I feel very hopeful. I see the light at the end of the tunnel.
That's a positive attitude. I remember at the beginning of your show you mentioned you were actually kind of happy, and maybe you could talk a little bit about that, like what you see in the future.
Well, I'm going to continue to provide food to my brothers and sisters whenever I can, in any way that I can, anywhere that they happen to be. I'm not going to stop. I'm certainly willing to go to jail over this issue. I quite frankly can't think of anything that I would rather go to jail for than a cup of soup.
Well, that's a very courageous stance. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, this was an interesting thought that came into my mind the other day, that I now can legally burn the American flag, but I cannot legally serve a cup of soup to someone who's hungry.
Well, now that's one issue, is apparently burning a flag is protected speech, but there are political overtones to your serving soup also, are there not?
Not for myself, no.
Oh.
Not a political issue for me at all. In fact, I don't understand politics, and quite frankly don't approve of what little I do understand. This is an issue of love for me. Love takes many forms and expressions, and food is one of them. Now, some would say that this might be an expression of free speech, which probably is true. But for me, this is a right. And more than that, I have a moral obligation.
Mm-hmm.
Feed people if they are hungry, if they are not being taken care of. I have a moral obligation to do that. And no one is going to interfere with that. I will not allow it. They can arrest me, I can go on trial, they can put me in jail, but I am not going to stop.
Okay. Well, thank you, and more power to you.
Thank you. Thank you for getting in touch with me.
Uh-huh. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. On another local homeless rights advocate and free food activist, and he has a couple of numbers he'd like to give our listeners if they'd like to become more involved. So, Tom, do you want to put him on the air? You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just very impressed with your interview with Sandy Loringer, and I wanted to advise your listeners that if they themselves want to do something to end this harassment of people who are serving the homeless food, they might consider a couple suggestions. One is call the DA's office at 425-2071, that's 425-2071, between 8 and 12, and then again between 1 and 5, and ask them questions like why they are going after people who are serving the homeless food, but let's say not after other organizations that actually shouldn't be gone after either, but that have been allowed to serve food for, well, months if not years, from the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program or the River Street Shelter, other groups. Similarly, there's a city council meeting on Tuesday at 7:30. There will be an oral communications period, that's day after tomorrow, when people can actually speak personally to the city council and, again, air your concern about this, or you can call the city council's number or call Mayor Wormhout at 429-3550, 429-3550. Or if you're interested in actually serving people food, I myself am not allowed, because I'm under an injunction, to advise people to do this. But everyone is free to do what their conscience bids them to do. If people wish to provide, to get further information about this, or to, they can call me at 458-9648, and I'd be happy to speak to them personally. And they can also go down to the mall itself, where food often appears in the late afternoon, and talk to homeless people. Again, the numbers of the DA's office, 425-2071. The city council is 429-3550. My number is 458-9648. As well as letters to the Sentinel, letters to the Pajaronian, letters to the Good Times and the Sun, expressing your feelings can have an effect.
Mm-hmm.
I really think it's wonderful that you're providing the coverage that essentially no media has provided. There was a brief story in the Sentinel last week, but it was full of errors, and generally people don't know what's happening about the food business. They think that there's just a lot of troublemakers who are running around creating a lot of ruckus, which I think is wholly inaccurate.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
And that's about it for Earthbeat tonight. Any more PSAs, Tom?
No.
And a quick addition. Actually, there is another update from a wildfire out at Lapis Road in Monterey County. She describes the struggle that she and others have been engaged in, and the latest updates from out there to allow RV dwellers to be in their homes, which are their vehicles, without them being towed away or essentially removed from them, because they have to move them, and then they can't find legal places to park them. Well, listen in on that, too.
Keith,
Tell us about the organization that you are involved in and that you founded, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I founded a worldwide movement called Food Not Bombs, and your pork introduction kind of goes well with that because we actually share all vegan meals in over 1,000 cities and over 65 countries. And so I get kind of a global perspective on the issue of hunger and poverty and a national perspective on efforts to close down Food Not Bombs meals, something that's becoming kind of a national wave of this. I don't think it's nationally coordinated, but it's city after city have proposed getting rid of what they call street feeding. And so Food Not Bombs has been doing this like for, I'm about to hit 38 years of doing this.
Really?
Yeah. And in May, I'll be 38 years.
What has happened recently around the downtown Santa Cruz post office? Because there's been a big change.
Yeah. Well, what happened was that there became a stepped-up enforcement and new extreme ordinances to drive the homeless out of sight in other parts of downtown, particularly around the library and around City Hall. And there was stepped up enforcement in the Pognos and on San Lorenzo River. And eventually people got squeezed to one intersection. And this is a policy of Martin Bernal, the city manager. And so he was able to create this whole series of ordinances and laws and enforcement through the Parks and Rec Department and through the police to drive everyone to the corner of Front Street and Water Street and along Pacific Avenue and some of the alleys along the surrounding area, the town clock, and so on. So we saw people, and then they stopped having enforcement at that corner. That's why you started seeing an encampment there, because the pressure to move people away was much less. And then we would hear of potential sweeps of people. So we share food there every Saturday and Sunday from 4 to 6, and it's all volunteer effort, and we've been doing it we started in Santa Cruz in 1992. And so we've seen like these kind of ill thought of campaigns to really drive homeless around. I just got an email from Phoenix, Arizona, where they're doing the same thing, where they call it whack-a-mole, where they will do a whole pressure campaign to move the homeless from one part of town. They all get ticketed, arrested, and have their belongings confiscated, and then they move to another area. Well, that's what's been happening here. The Recreation Parks Department, Police Department, and come in, they'll ticket people in an area, take their belongings, often survival property that they need, blankets and shoes and things like that. Sure. And then give them their $179 ticket for being outside, a sleeping ticket or obstruction of street ticket. Then they get the $300 assessment for not paying that, since they're homeless and they can't afford to pay that, and then they move to the next thing. And so a lot of the people, there's almost a little safe community of women in front of the post office, which was really, you know, it's kind of tragic. What has happened most recently, a woman, beginning of not this month, October, but a month before, came to us, and she had been, she lived here on the streets for one day. She lived in Santa Cruz for 43 years, and she was born here. And she tried getting into the homeless services center, the shelter there. She had visited the women's center on Walnut Street, Elm Street. She talked to the people there. She couldn't find any place. And I didn't know, she had not been frequenting Food Not Bombs, so I didn't really know of her. But a friend that comes every Saturday and Sunday introduced me to her. And I said, well, you know, they have a program here. We can get a bus ticket to Homeward Bound, and we can hook you up with Chris and get you a free ticket home. And she goes, I am home. I've been living here my entire life. So that's what we ended up doing is making an arrangement where some of the older people, older men that we know, that we trust, that have been living on the streets for a few months themselves, one case only, like about 2 months, agreed to like kind of watch out for in a doorway on Front Street. And so this is kind of the system that's happening. So eventually a Reiki professional who lost her home, she's been at the post office. There's a person with stage 4 cancer who has been sitting in a wheelchair at the post office. There, it's a couple of these are basically people.
So it's become a safe zone.
It's a safe zone for women who are afraid to live like by themselves in other parts of town. And
why are the authorities looking the other way or having a little burst of compassion, whereas in other parts of the city they don't?
Well, I'm
is there
thinking
some status that the federal building has? I mean, I don't.
I think that's part of it. It's unclear who has jurisdiction, but also I do think that the new chief of police has had made an impact, Andy Mills, and he has actually gone there and introduced himself to each and every one of the people in front of the post office.
Wow.
And he has shown a big heart. And so I think that the part of it, the town is new to Andy Mills, the politics of it. It's actually similar politics, really, ultimately, to what we saw in Eureka, where he was chief of police before. But, he's still different players and different magnitudes.
Sounds like a class act with a heart.
Yeah, he's like, so far from our experience, we've seen that he's come to Funabombs several times. And the homeless people themselves at the post office have said he was really gracious. So they tried to – he actually told them that they would be moving a couple of different times and then that would be canceled. And then I'm not so sure. I think that there was a sweep finally of the – if you go by the post office now, there's nobody there.
Oh, really?
There's nobody down in that area except for at the town clock.
Like a couple of days ago.
Correct. And so they – a lot of people lost really important belongings in the sweep, sleeping bags, tents, blankets. Andy Mills was not like overseeing it directly, although it was his department that came out and did this. They offered some hotel vouchers for one night to some of the people living in front of the post office, but told them to go to San Lorenzo Park and they would reduce their enforcement there. What we're finding, we are monitoring this really very closely and trying to film it and so on. And what we're finding is that the Rangers will then have a different story. And I've heard that there's some frustration between both the Parks Department and the Police Department because there's not really, unfortunately, direct. There's somehow some miscommunication. And so you'll get the Rangers will ticket people for being in San Lorenzo Park. And the Sheriff's Department has been over there ticketing people because of when they're near the county building. And then it's not clear what will happen with people that are now moving to San Lorenzo Park. But the real issue, I think, is that, I remember when I first came down here, right before the earthquake, I was feeding people up in San Francisco, and I would come to the city council meetings and urge a single room occupancy hotel be built. Then when the earthquake happened, I'm like, well, here's a perfect time to get federal funding to provide housing. And we all know from many studies that it's much cheaper for the government and for the city, for the federal government, the state government, the city government, the county, if the people are housed. I mean, you can't imagine some of the stories of us getting people off the streets to the hospital, thousands of dollars a day to deal with them there. And that money could have just, they would have not had to go to the hospital at thousands of dollars a day had they had a little studio apartment. Now, not everybody will cooperate. There's all kinds of issues around people, are told they could get housing if they take Prozac, but they don't want to, things like that. This very complex series of issues. But I think, when I started Funabombs in 1980, I actually had to get a group of people to dress up like hobos to organize a soup line in front of the Federal Reserve Bank in South Boston in a protest against the policies of the Bank of Boston, who were basically investing in, in our case, the thing we were worried about was the nuclear arms race and Seabrook Nuclear Power Station without any oversight. They were basically, they owned all the companies and lent themselves money. So, you know, there was roughly 100,000 homeless Americans in 1980, and now we have millions and millions. There's over 2,500,000 homeless children now in the United States, and that's of like from 2015. Who knows what it is now? And you know, public school systems will have hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of children in their schools that are actually have no place to go after school because they live in their parents' car or and you know, under a freeway or something.
It's heartbreaking.
So, yeah, you know, I'm writing an article now because you know, if many of the listeners probably experienced this. You know, trying to hustle to pay their bills, to pay their mortgage, to, you know, they know that tension. And just to, you know, already in October, I've met six people who this is the first month of their life they've been homeless. And I, in the 38 years I've been doing this, I might meet one, two people a month that tell me they just became homeless that month. Sometimes months will go by where no one comes to me saying that they had just become homeless. But in May, there were six people in, during the whole month that who spent their first days on the streets in May. And it's,
how do they know to come to you, and why do they come to you?
They come to me because, one, people living on the streets know they can trust me. And two, I have a very large, visible presence. Food Not Bombs has a very it's part of the reason Food Not Bombs has a very large, visible presence at the corner of Front and Water Streets. And it's to be visible. It's to make sure that the public knows that we are actually spending, from my perspective, at least half the federal income taxes that we pay on the military while we let our veterans live in the streets. And if we could spend, you know, we are, the United States is half of the world's military spending. You know, our taxpayers, our militaries, uses half of the oil that the United States purchases is used by the U.S. military. That's we could have a huge impact on society if we built one less, aircraft carrier. We don't need to have many, many aircraft carriers. And Food Not Bombs has never called for an end to the U.S. military necessarily. It's just to have appropriate spend money domestically on things that make it possible for you not to end up on the streets. And now that I have this back injury and I'm in a walker, there's so many people come to me and tell me the story of how they were a construction worker and a sheet of plywood blew into the, you know, out of their arms, and they were trying to catch it, and their back went out, and they ended up in the hospital. They ended up on disability. Their disability ran out. They, one thing after another, and they end up on the street. And I hear this story over and over and over again. And I have one friend that worked for AT&T, was a mechanic for the fleet. He's one of the people at the post office. He injured himself trying to catch a piece of equipment. At work, he does have a disability check, but it's not enough to get into an apartment in Santa Cruz. He doesn't want to take opiates. He ended up turning to drinking. He ends up having been robbed all the time. He lives with nothing. He's a very smart person. And it's a shame. This is our workers. These are the people that are living at the post office, or actually, you know, people that have held jobs, do hold jobs, but just cannot afford to get an apartment, or can't organize themselves, or don't have, we've helped some people by them having their belongings at our place, and that gives them a chance to go get a job because they don't have to show up.
What place are you talking about?
At the little apartment that my partner and I rent. And so if we stash somebody's bag there, or we put it in the Food Not Bombs van, and they can go, you can't show up to a job interview with a backpack and a sleeping bag without a shower. And or in the case of the most recent person we helped, he couldn't go stand at outside of San Lorenzo Hardware on 41st and get picked up like with the other immigrant workers. And he's not an immigrant. He actually came here from Florida. because this is where he had been as a youngster, and he'd seen news of the floods, and he's a very skilled builder, and he thought, well, there's going to be a lot of work out here rebuilding places that were damaged. He saw this all in the news, and so he came back here because he had friends that he knew, and it turned out his friends were out of town when he got here, and he started sleeping with us at the city hall during the Freedom Sleepers, and just by us simply stashing his providing him a safe place to stash his belongings so he could show up, because no one's going to hire you standing on a street corner with a backpack and a sleeping bag, that diminishes your possibility of employment. But now he has his own little room and everything, and he's off the streets. And we have like case after case where the simple issue of storage of a person's belongings and just not, you know, having that freedom to go out and look for work changes people's lives. And so a simple thing of the city to just provide storage spaces, or to do like we had here in the 70s when I was like on the, passing through, I was like a street waif back in those days, and I'd go on the wharf and do paintings and try to sell them to tourists and so on. But we had the switchboard, and you could leave your stuff at the switchboard on Pacific Avenue, and
I sort of remember that.
Yeah, you know, that a simple little thing like that can change. When the winter shelter opened last, we have a couple of people that eat with Food Not Bombs that just were so happy that they could leave their belongings at the winter shelter and go out and do things. And they would just every time they saw us, they would rave about the main point for them of the winter shelter was that the belongings could be safely stored somewhere. And it's like little simple things like that, you know, we're like one of the wealthiest communities in the world. And yet we can't, you know, like thousands and thousands of dollars of people's personal belongings, or the city pays more money to throw away people's blankets and sleeping bags and tents than it would cost to provide a storage space for people to put those belongings in them. And they would not, it's tragic. Like we have to, people come to us like, we gave them a blanket on Tuesday, and on Saturday they don't have any blanket again. We're giving them another blanket, you know, and they're in tears. Can imagine last night sleeping on the sidewalk in Santa Cruz, California, down on the...
I can't imagine that.
Yeah, and no blankets. Yeah. And that's why we're having people dying of hypothermia. Like, you know, we've been having memorial services for our friends. And
is there any data available, Keith, about how many homeless people there are? In other words, if someone's magic fingers could be snapped and the problem could be solved with building of some single occupancy rooms or whatever you call them, how many people? There's probably no end to it, right? Because isn't it true that Santa Cruz is well known for being a haven for homeless people? I don't mean to sound, you know.
No, well, it's well known amongst housed people in Santa Cruz. But it's actually a myth, and you know, I've been feeding the hungry, and I visit my groups in cities all over the country, in every city. I mean, I remember I was like in Cleveland in the winter, and the people that were saying all the homeless come to Cleveland because it's got the best services. Well, in, you know, January, what homeless person wants to go live outside in Cleveland? So that's a nationwide myth that every city has. And actually this town is famous for, in the homeless circles as the one place you don't go if you're homeless. This is a very...
Because of the camping ban and all that?
Yeah, because of the camping ban, because of the restrictions, because of, you know, the shelter has no space. It's well known that's the case, and that you're going to end up, this is one of the roughest places possible to live because of government policies. So it's very interesting that we have this belief. So there is a point, the counties, every county to get federal funding from HUD has to do a census, and I was involved with this census this past year, and an outside agency does the audit to make sure that it's the method is as close to accurate as possible. And they found that there was over 900 people living outside in Santa Cruz, in the city limits of Santa Cruz, on this horrible rainy night, morning that you could, you know, it's just unbelievable. We certainly missed a lot of people. But the official figure was around 900. And in surveys of the people where they questioned the length of time, is over 68% of the people said they had been living in a house in Santa Cruz for at the time they became homeless, and a similar percentage, a little bit higher, have lived here for 10 years or greater. And it doesn't say, you know, I know from direct experience, a huge number of the people on the streets actually were born and raised here. In fact, one of the people at the town clock was born here 61 years ago, and his mother was born here, and his grandmother was born here. So to use the term transient for probably nearly half the population is a misnomer, because many of the people that live on our streets actually have lived here many decades longer than the people in city council. So, you know, it's quite a misstatement of fact to say that. And it's obvious. These are the children of people who built Santa Cruz, but they did not have the income to afford to buy land or property in Santa Cruz,
who can afford to pay the rent.
So that, you know, these are the, you know, some of these people that are living on the streets are the actual very people that built some of the buildings that the people that are complaining about the homeless are living in.
Wow.
You know, so, you know, I think there are a lot of solutions. There's actually going to be at the Homeless Service Center a meeting, and it's called Smart Solutions, and I don't remember the day. I think it's Wednesday, the 25th. But there is a proposal to make a 100-unit facility where there's 100 studio apartments, little tiny studio apartments. And this person's getting those outside funding and so on. It's like to me, it sounds like a very workable program, and to get 100 people off the streets.
Do they have a site in mind?
And it's near the Homeless Service Center, I believe, but I'm not sure with the details of that. But that's the kind of solution. You know, we saw San Francisco, which I provided meals for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you could see the pattern there. When I got there, I rented an apartment for $450, a one-room bedroom apartment. And I was actually living on the streets, and I was able to get off the streets and into an apartment relatively quickly. You know,
I bet that apartment would be closer to $2,000.
Yeah, it could easily be that. Yeah. Uh-huh. And the thing was that you could see that there's many causes of homelessness, but in San Francisco, containerized shipping, the invention of that, played a huge role in the increase of homelessness. And because then many of the people that lived there were dock workers that unloaded the ships. And they lived in single-room occupancy hotels, many of them. And then they did redevelopment. They put the Moscone Center up, the Museum of Modern Art. They leveled hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of buildings that were affordable for people to live in little rooms and stay off the streets. By the end of that, many of those people ended up homeless. The other thing was, of course, you have the issue of subsidized housing and public housing projects, which had term limits on their leases. And many, when an area of a city became more profitable, the lease was up with the federal government, people would turn them into condominiums. So massive amounts of public housing that was constructed after the Great Depression.
Yeah.
So you have like, all these, there's a solution to this, actually, and it's changing national priorities, and that's why we have the name Food Not Bombs for the entire 38 years. Because I love the people that eat with Food Not Bombs, and we try to get people both housed and unhoused, all hanging out together to like a festival every Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6 at the post office, to put a human face on what's going on, to bring some levity and some kind of a vacation from the harshness of living on the streets, and to provide as nutritional, healthy, you know, organic, vegan meal as we possibly can, with, and show a sense of abundance, because we try to provide so much food you don't have to worry about not leaving full. You can eat as much as you want. And this is because we want to create a community atmosphere that, you know, we can turn this around. We can go back to the 1980 where there was virtually no homeless Americans. And it would be cheaper for everybody in society, and it would certainly be much less painful for people. You know, I'm starting out an article I'm writing now about just that stress that one feels before you lose your housing in your attempt to save that housing. I think many of us that are housed feel that, you know, the bills piling up, the wages staying stagnant, but the cost of utilities, the rent going up, all of that. Imagine the stress of that, and you have a house, and then all of a sudden, one day, you're in somebody's, parents' couch, or you're on a friend's couch, or you're in the back, you've got a car. I mean, the stories I hear of people, they moved from the apartment that they got where the landlord got foreclosed on, into their car. Their car eventually gets ticketed so much, you're not allowed to sleep in your car. They get ticketed so badly, their car gets confiscated. Now that was their house. Now they're living in a people's, you know, couches. They're under stress themselves trying to pay their bills. That you eventually move out and you end up living on the streets. And this, you know, not that everybody that's all, you know, there's definitely a lot of drug use. I'd say a lot of people that use drugs and drink on the streets actually weren't really before they were on the streets. It's just the pain of being on the streets as such. And imagine, sadly, it's cheaper to buy heroin or meth than it is to, you know, buy many magnitudes cheaper than a night in a hotel room. Why have a system that's like that? So, you know, I think
we're talking
tragic.
With Keith McHenry, founder of Food Not Bombs. We're talking about the homeless situation here in Santa Cruz, which mirrors that situation in many, many communities across the country. I think we'll go ahead and open the phone lines now. 831-479-1080 if you want to call in and ask Keith a question, make a comment. MZ@KSCO.com. Oh, I should open my email box here to do that, but let's go to the phone board here and hit take next, and I guess that would put Sean and Live Oak on first. Hey, Sean, welcome to KSCO. You're on the air. Santa Cruz regarding UCSC and the post office. Hey, Pete, you're on.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I'd just like to make a couple comments and get your opinion. I personally say hooray for the cleanup of downtown. It is worse than it's ever been. I've been a resident of Santa Cruz my whole life. My wife has also. We're property tax paying citizens, and the city is decaying. And the last few months, when you go downtown, they've had to cordon off the post office, and my belief is we're diverting the conversation to some kind of national everything instead of focusing the old bumper sticker, think globally, act locally. I think we need to act locally and think locally. What are the causes here? And I personally think we have the resources and the models. UCSC, it is mandated to grow every year. So as fast as your guest works, they're piling more mountain on top of his back. We're adding more people to the problem before we have to stop the problem. We have to contain UCSC. They have the resources and the brain power up there to get the data on these homeless people. Let's find out who they are, where they are, what they need. I mean, what does UCSC do to help in this situation? I believe it's in their model, in their mandate that they are going to grow, but they also have to make sure they help the cities and the communities they're involved with as they grow, that their plan works with the city. Well, I don't see that happening. I'm wondering if you have any input or thought on that, because I really believe with the way the university is growing on Seabright right now, for example, they had a gentleman build 11 units. When he went to the city council in the meeting, he said these are going to be for young families with kids. I'm going to sell them to young families, da da da. Well, now they're on the market and they're for lease. They're between $46 to $4,800 each, and they're perfectly set up for three students, and they're going to all end up being rented to students. And it's not going to help our homeless situation in any way. The county, technically the city will say, well, we don't, it's the county's problem, but it's our problem. I'm a taxpayer in the city, and I don't want to go downtown near the post office because my wife and my grandchildren are afraid, and it's scary, and there are people that honestly need help, but there are scary people down there, scary, that want to confront you, that are looking for a confrontation. So something had to be done, I believe, and I commend the police chief if it was him. But we need to focus on the solution, not short-term, a long-term solution. Stop all the growth right now until we get a grip on it. That's my belief. I'm just wondering what you gentlemen think.
Well, I actually agree. I mean, I do think that the amount of people on Pacific Avenue, because I spend a ton of my time on Pacific Avenue, is huge. I mean, the amount of tourists and the amount of people shopping, and it's actually the homeless population, generally speaking, is not, is actually part of the entertainment on Pacific Avenue. But I can appreciate people, it's not cool to see. If you're a compassionate person, it's terrible to see people living on the streets. And I think that's it. You bring to mind something that when Food Not Bombs started in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Harvard and MIT were not actually paying taxes to the city. They were not involved in solutions. But I also have to say that fortunately, some of the professors at the university have been really proactive on the issue of homelessness. In fact, there will be a release of a study in coordination with city council that was conducted by the students, a huge, really well-organized study on the housing issue in Santa Cruz. And it's not completely bleak, but their basic idea is correct. But here's the interesting aspect of what you're saying is many of the major developers, and I myself surprised at how untransparent this is in Santa Cruz, because like when I was in San Francisco, you could tell follow the money trail really easily. And here, it seems like the pressure, particularly on the city manager, and therefore on the city council, is to make this the most developer-friendly town possible. And so a lot of the policies are around maximizing profit for developers and builders, and it's not around providing solutions to solving the homeless problem. So basically,
if I could interject, I developed a piece of property down near the beach. I'm a craftsman. I work with my hands. And I paid $40,000 in permits into the schools and upgraded the whole infrastructure of my street, the sidewalk, the sewer, everything. So the only way that any infrastructure is getting paid for is by people developing their property, because our tax money that we're getting from our transit occupancy tax and our sales tax are not going to any infrastructure. If you look at the budget by Martin Bunnell, they don't even project any capital expenditures in the next 5 years because there's no money for it. So if they don't allow development, then they're not spending a penny on any capital. So they've got a real problem here.
It sounds to me like they're potentially a smaller developer, but I think the control.
No, I'm just a homeowner. I'm right. A homeowner that I work with my hands. I have a job. I work 40 hours a week. I grew up here. My parents went to Santa Cruz High. I'm just a local kid but I'm saying I wanted to fix my property. I had to fix up my sidewalk, but all my neighbors' sidewalks are crumbling because nobody is doing any work on the infrastructure. The reason I brought the UCSC up is because there was an article in the paper in the last month that said 350 foreign students were brought in to fill their enrollment at UCSC last minute to make sure they got their quota. And these were kids from China who had never been to Santa Cruz that were walking around going, oh, this is a neat place. I think, we'd like to come here. We wanted to go to UCLA or Berkeley, but yeah, we'll go to UCSC. So somehow we have the resources and the programs and everything set up to automatically find those 350 students housing. Why don't we somehow use that model for our homeless people?
Absolutely.
get a resource that we can find housing and mandate UCSC to be part of this. Look, if you want to have 350 new students, you're going to have to tell us where we can house 100 homeless people. Some kind of ratio. So, I mean, something. We have to.
Well, I agree. I think you hit a really important thing.
Yeah. I think so, too. But it's been a one-way street all these years. How do you change the law so that UCSC has to be accountable to anybody?
Right. And then you have
How do you do that? Because right now they are accountable to nobody.
Yeah, you have that issue, and
they
then you
have
these.
Our waters, they get to have our sewers, but they are not subject to the development of the planning process and so forth that all the rest of us are.
Right, and I assume that they somewhat are, well, one are not out of, you know, there being a lot of the policies are being operated out of the headquarters of the university system, but and therefore totally not listening. I suspect that there's a similar problem in other. Like in Berkeley, for example, and in UCLA. I mean, you see the homeless camps around UCLA are outrageous.
Yeah, it's incredible.
So I think that, this was a, like I said, I think this is a, you hit a really good point. And then there's this balance you hear about, well, the amount of water use, if they build more buildings up at the campus to house people, and then you talk to students, and then you've got like four students in a room. I mean, this is like unbelievable that, and then maybe, you know, why bring foreign students in? I don't know if that's really an issue. They get somehow more money. But then I know the university system wastes tons of money on things that are just ridiculous. And I, you know, as you probably remember, if you're old enough to, and were here, or at least your parents would know that I remember when I first was hanging out at Kresge, when it first opened, you know, people were paying $100 fee, you know, per semester to go to the university if they were a state student.
And I remember like, $129 per quarter. That's what I remember, but I think it was cheaper even before.
Yeah, it's just crazy.
I'd like to get out of the way, let somebody else have some science.
Yeah, but thanks for your really
that
kind.
Very considerate of you, Pete, in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, and very good comments.
Keep doing what you're doing, because remember two things. You have to look at yourself in the mirror, and the kids are watching, and it seems like you remember that.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thanks for your comments are fantastic.
Thanks for calling 479-1080, where a line has just opened up. Wendy and Ben Lohman, your turn.
Oh, well, I was hoping to get on a little earlier before we absolutely annoyed all of the people who are out as evacuees. We have about, like, one-tenth of the population of San Francisco is on the road, and they have relatives, and we've just made Santa Cruz look about the worst we could possibly. That last caller was like, oh, my goodness. What is it, the last absolutely sexist organization, that Old Timers of Santa Cruz group that makes it so no one can leave? I mean,
now, wait a minute here.
Come on.
I'm on the board of directors.
You have money coming out your reamers.
There is
and you're
no
not
money
buying
at all.
The cash-only, you know, $10,000 houses that are all over the Rust Belt, all over the Deep South.
What are you
South.
Talking about?
Syracuse.
I want you to say it again. Say it again, and I will correct you.
Did you say old-timers
of Santa Cruz?
Let's send our good friends, our homeless friends, off into the wilderness alone. No, you send them into a house that you bought in Ohio or in Detroit or in the one I wanted, a beautiful one, that would have, you know, made anything in Seabright look really, really bad in Albany, Georgia, which is a nice town. My father was raised there. And it was $16,000. And it had a great, huge, you know, amount of land around it. Things that our people can do. We need to colonize. Get them out of here if they, you know, having people protect women in doorways? Come on, guys. You can't do that.
Well,
take that responsibility for her life.
Well, the horrible thing is that, you know, I've met a number of people, and you can get a bus ticket home, right? But so many of the people, their families are here. Their hope. It's very hard if you're.
What? Yeah, I was raised in a very, very affluent suburb. I haven't been able to get near there ever. It happens. You can't say that I've been here forever, because guess what? A university came in here, and there's only one person in this world who will live in such degraded conditions as we often have around here, as the poor would have normally in a normal place, and that's students, and they took them all. You have no place. You're never going to have place. If you build more students will come.
Yeah.
I'm saying have them colonize. Your friends, you're saying you have carpenters. Oh, my gosh. I have seen houses that make me drool. Antiques that would make anyone around here just, you know, these people in Sonoma would wring your neck for not, you know, taking advantage of these people in other parts of the country and ship the antiques back to us for we'll sell them for $3,000 or $4,000, things you get in the trash in Syracuse.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know from experience that, you know, so I became homeless when I lived in San Francisco, but I was in Kansas at the time, even though my apartment was in San Francisco, and I was able to get off the streets really quickly. But I think most people are not, you know,
here.
It's not so much
it's not
that.
Kansas.
But I think a lot of it, though, is that people feel that their chances of survival are better if they're in an area that they know and that they have connections.
This is like Khan of we are the new Khan here. This is so high end. We cannot think about things like, oh, we've been here forever. You know, people are moving everywhere, and
yeah, well, I just
I
think
say that it's. You know, you're given, you know, giving calls. There are, you know, you are, you know, there are problems with giving, you know, food that the system has already, you know, dealt with to, you know, random people. It really is not a, you know, I can see the problems. If you have a lot of assurance from the people who are selling it, from the manufacturers, et cetera, because, you know, you're asking for, you know, problems, and you are, you're feeding the birds.
Well, no, these
instead
are the people that these are
making money on those great houses out there that are going to be destroyed if someone who doesn't understand how beautiful the rest of the country is, you know, takes advantage of it. Snow is better than rain, guys. Okay.
Well, except for when you're living when you're living outside.
Yeah, but you're not going to have them living outside. If they get home, if they just burn down that house you bought in Cincinnati, the house you bought that they have a room in that looks like awful because it still needs to have the plaster redone. It's a very long and detailed job that would have cost a fortune here. So they tear the houses that are nice here down because we can't afford the labor because the housing is so expensive to rebuild them. So we save them in other parts of the country.
Well, yeah, my experience of traveling across the United States and feeding hungry people and
You're not going to have them be hungry. You organize your money people to not buy stock in ridiculous monopolies that are destroying the whole fabric of everything that a homemaker in this country knows. We have lost so many good brands to ridiculous monopolies that no one is even watching. We can't even keep a home. Why have a home when you don't know how to take care of it? And you are, you know, and they're taking the products that are working that I learned from my mother very difficultly, a lot of time that I get no credit for at all. I am downplayed for even knowing what to do with a piece of wood. Oh, you put lemon oil on it. What would people, you know, the homeless people know that? So let's put them in a nice home so that they destroy it? No, you start out with a destroyed home, a home that's been given up where they have no, you know, infrastructure except what we can stream to them. And, you know, you're going to make a heck of a lot more buying a $10,000 home somewhere else and buy 40 of them than one here.
Well, if you got the resources, I
think
certainly
your people do.
Well,
I mean, who am I talking to? I'm talking to 10,000 people with a lot of money. It's not just you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah. Well,
thank you
first.
For being, so allow me to get passionate.
Well, if any listeners want to buy property in another city and
evacuees,
house people,
we love you. Please come. Okay.
Okay.
We are not horrible. All right.
All right, thank you, Wendy. Appreciate your
call. Yeah, Wendy brings up an interesting point. You know, I was feeding people in San Francisco after Loma Prieta, and the first 3 days there was no food but food not bombs at the Civic Center Plaza. And then finally, thank goodness, Red Cross was able to come in and everything and help out. But then there became, I remember at Moscone Center was a shelter after the earthquake, and then there was the so-called good homeless and the bad homeless. So people that were made homeless by the earthquake, the newly homeless, were the good homeless. And then 12 months later, a lot of those people became the bad homeless. And we see that with the hurricanes. Sadly, we'll see this again with probably with what's going on with the fires where people, wow, you know, are sheltered. Because they are directly made homeless by the catastrophe, but then 12 months later, the inability to find housing, and they become the people living in front of the post office that we hate. You know, this is just a tragic scenario that goes on and on and on. Katrina, I was super involved in feeding Katrina, and I can't imagine how many people I've run into since Katrina who became homeless because of Katrina. But they were in a shelter as a hurricane victim, treated, you know, with some dignity, and then a year later, they're just the horrible homeless that we need to get rid of.
We've all.
Hi, hi, MZ.
Hi.
Keith, I was listening to the C-SPAN book channel about 10 months ago, and they gave an hour to an author who was most notably the founder, female founder of America's first black-centric bookstore. And most of their books were a combination black history, pro-revolution. They were involved with the Black Panthers. And they were early on into the free food for the poor and the homeless program. And I found it very interesting that she said, her words, not mine, our goal was to get Americans to see food as a right. Then why not housing? Why not free medical and dental care, clothing, etc.? Or Bernie Sanders wants free college. Others want free daycare. I'd like to know what your guest's opinion is of capitalism and what his opinion is of communism.
We miss your calls, Neil. Great, great question.
Okay, yeah, I like that. Well, I happen to be friends with one of the founders of the Black Panther Breakfast Program in Connecticut, who lives now in San Francisco, Kilo Nasha. And I do you meet me and I give you my business card. It says food is a right, not a privilege. And I think there are a number of things that are universally, other than the United States, believed are basic human rights, including and one of those is food. And I think no people can live without food. And as far as communism or capitalism, I think that we need to transform our society into a whole new economic and political system. But it has to be a transformation. It has to be one that's
fundamentally transform. I've heard that phrase before. Continue,
yeah.
Please.
Yeah. And so, and I don't know what that would be, but part of the point of us handing out free vegan meals on 500 street corners in the United States and another 500 elsewhere is to create a dialogue, be an open space for dialogue to come up with some of these visions. And some unusual things have grown out of these conversations at Food Not Bombs Meals. An early one was Indie Media, which was born at a Food Not Bombs meal and conversation in the 90s, which became some young Food Not Bombs activists figured out how to upload without an obvious file transfer program audio, video, and photo to the web. And now, you know, of course, a lot of us are so used to that with Facebook. But there was some young Food Not Bombs kids at a Food Not Bombs meal in Melbourne, Australia that thought that would be a great idea and then figured out the software. So that's the thing, is to create like an open dialogue and an inspiring situation where we transform our society in a way that is sustainable and survivable. So, you know, I have a great many friends that share vegan meals in former communist countries, and I was in, in Eastern Europe quite a bit right after the Berlin Wall came down. And you know, sadly, you know, many people there pointed out that, you know, it was really clear what some of the failures of that political system are and were. But there were some other interesting things that I was surprised about that I'd never occurred to me. And one of those was I was staying with an East German family in Leipzig and who had spent their whole lives in the GDR. And their vision of us all being in the society together, just in one generation, they were able to, like, absorb this idea that we're all in this together. So that attitude is something that we really could foster here in the United States. So while having an authoritarian top-down government was obviously and having a centralized economic system. Those things are huge problems, not only for the people living under those systems, but also for the rest of us, because they contributed a great deal to the to many of the environmental crises that we're seeing now. And but at the same time, capitalism has the same parallel mirror image aspects that of crisis developing ideas, systems, principles, and so I think we really need to get away from all of those kind of political and economic systems. And all so right, then well, I see, like, I've been not exactly a capitalist. I think I was like, I would differentiate between being a capitalist and being a business person that's selling things in a kind of a marketplace type of situation. And I owned an ad agency for many years and had some really interesting clients, like the Boston Red Sox and the Celtics and so on. So I'm not against making money. I'm just against, like, a kind of controlled economic system that...
Poor Neil wants to say something.
Yeah, let you go, Neil. Sorry.
I'm being subjected to a filibuster. What I would like to do is introduce your guest to some history in terms of the ideas and the dialogue and whatever. What he's suggesting was tried. One of the earliest settlements in North America was communal. And the die-off rate and the rate of starvation was extraordinary. And a subsequent settlement was based on the maxim, no work, no eat. And it was amazing how they flourished. The result of their efforts was so bountiful that they had, like, the first so-called Thanksgiving with the Indians. So we know historically that capitalism has created a higher standard of living. I'm talking about toilets, sanitation, the whole thing, better than any other system in the world. And what we have is based on the Constitution, which is a rare lightning strike of liberty in world history. And the Constitution doesn't say anything about tangible rights. All of the rights are intangible, and it gives you the freedom and the liberty to pursue your own interests. And as pharmacist Ben, by the way, says that you're probably wondering, where is he going with this? Well, pharmacist Ben says that the health of a body is based on the health of the organs, and the health of the organs is based on the health of the cells. And if you were to use that as an analogy, it comes down to individual responsibility. And when you make people dependent. In other words, we don't feed the bears because you wind up with bears that can no longer fend for themselves. And by Keith's own figures, around 1980, as I recall, he said there were about 100,000 homeless. More recently, in 2015, there were 2.5 million homeless children. Well, I'm thinking Keith is feeding the bears, you know? And he may not like to confront this, but people who've lived on the streets and who've called stations like KSEO, by the way.
There is no station like KSEO.
Well, true, but my point is that street people are calling and saying most of these folks out here with me on the streets are drug addicts or have mental problems. And another piece of history is that although Reagan is blamed for heartlessly turning the people in the institutions out into the streets, his predecessor, Pat Brown, already arranged that in terms of the law, because it was a matter of patients' rights. I mean, you can't keep people locked up and you can't force them to take meds and so on and so forth. So I'm seeing a push for socialism, communism, going through the back door, so to speak.
Well, that's certainly not what we're advocating necessarily. But I do, I find it interesting. For instance, sanitation, which we really appreciate here in the United States, of course, was imported from totalitarian countries in particularly Mesopotamia, and you know, when and you know, that's brought to us from Persia and from Muslim countries, and that was a huge effort. One of the reasons that the plague was ended was because of the Crusades and this information and sanitation being brought back to Europe by people who returned from the Crusades. So, I mean, it's a much more complex thing. And then I would say, you know, having lived near Plymouth, Massachusetts, it's quite clear that communal Native Americans were the people behind the survival of the Pilgrims initially. And you know, so that kind of thing goes on.
We have so many callers. Our lines are absolutely jammed. I'm blaming myself for not picking up the pace here, because if we don't pick up the pace from where it is, we're not going to get any other callers on, and that wouldn't be very nice.
No,
we've invited them to call, and they're calling.
He has some good points.
Neil,
you know.
thanks for calling. Don't be a stranger.
Thank you.
We miss your calls. Boy, we're going to. I think the call after next is going to be Paul, who's a small town downtown business owner. I don't know if that means Paul is small in stature or that his business is small, but I suppose we'll find out. But we're going to take the next caller, and that will be Jan in Santa Cruz. I think Paul is up next. Jan, you're on KSCO.
Hi. First of all, I would love, I'm honored to be speaking to the great-great-grand cousin of some dude that hung out with George Washington.
Really, thank you.
It's truly amazing. It is. And I've heard a lot of different places. You lived in Plymouth, Massachusetts, Boston, Kansas, but you were homeless in San Francisco, but you weren't sure. And then it's very confusing. I do want to know where you originally hailed from, because I know it's not Santa Cruz. But I do want to talk about Florida. That was interesting. You mentioned Florida quite a bit. And Florida, the city governments of Florida, both Orlando, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Tampa, have all had issues with Food Not Bombs, and ironically enough, have also had major issues with the hacker group Anonymous.